Welcome back, everybody, to Hoops HD. We have a very special audio-only podcast that we're recording here on the evening of June 15th. I'm Chad Sherwood, joined by a pair of Hoops HD regulars and David Griggs and John Tytel, and a very special guest, the current NCAA Director of Media Coordination and Statistics, and pretty much the guru of anything having to do with the selection process, David Warlock, joining us from the NCAA. David, thanks for joining us, first of all.
Hi, guys. Good to be with you all. Hope you're all doing well.
We're doing pretty good. And we had you on here about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago before the world went to hell, to put it mildly. But thanks for coming back. And first of all, it's middle of June, so I guess you got nothing to do this time of year. Is that right?
It is a bit of a slow time of the year. I'm not involved in the College World Series like I used to be. I'm a big baseball fan, so I miss that. And that championship begins Saturday, and it's a great event. But I'll just be a spectator and working pretty normal hours this time of year.
Yeah, that is great. I mean, the whole NCAA baseball tournament is great. It's actually, I think, a little bit underrated, but it's really exciting. But men's college basketball, I think, is your biggest thing. So when you think March Madness, you have a hand in, if not everything that happens, probably more than what happens than just about anybody else that I know. So just real quick, David, how did you get to where you are?
Complete luck. Not going to lie. It's something I did dream about from the time I was a kid. And that's the truth. I mean, I can tell you a lot of different stories, but you know, when back in, you know, the 2007 or 8 or whatever, when Facebook, you know, became a thing, and I got a Facebook account, and I started reconnecting with a lot of people from my past, which isn't easy because I grew up a military brat and lived in Germany most of my life, in my adolescence anyway, through fourth grade, seventh grade till I graduated. I went to an American school, and we had the same type of things as a normal high school here stateside would have, but everyone was from different cities, towns, and different states. I think our school was seventh grade through 12th, and we had, I think, 46 of the 50 states represented, or was at least one person from 46 of the states. And so people were coming in and out of my life all the time. So I had different best friends in seventh grade than I did in ninth grade, and ninth grade than I did my junior and senior year of high school. So Facebook allowed me to reconnect with a lot of people. And if I heard it once, I heard it 20 times. Man, you're doing exactly what you always wanted to do. And I heard it from people, you know, I went to grade school with, and heard it from people, you know, who I graduated from high school with. And it's a blessing to be able to do this. My background, my education, I didn't go to a big fancy school you've heard of. I went to a Division II school in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, Henderson State University. I was a journalism major, but quickly got involved working with the sports information director, and did that. And my work in that office, my final 3 years of school, led me to become the SID a year after I graduated. So I was 23, got the job because I knew all the coaches, knew the AD from working as a student assistant, and the SID who I worked for got out of the business, and I got his job. I did that for 8 years. And did a good enough job to get recognized by the NCAA from a statistics standpoint. And, you know, that kind of evolved as I got here in 2001. I was media coordinator for the indoor track championship in 2002, got involved with the College World Series a few years after that, and then was hired by the men's basketball staff in 2006. I'm back in statistics because we kind of reshuffled the championship staff, but still involved, obviously, with the men's basketball championship. And so this past year was supposed to be my 16th tournament because of 2020. It was my 15th tournament. So I've been doing this for a while, and, you know, hope to do it until I retire.
Yeah. David, let me ask you this. The last time we spoke to you was before the whole COVID thing hit. How has it been these last, let's go back to the middle of March of last year when everything hit the fan and the tournament got canceled, and then just the craziness of getting through a season here in the 2020-21 season. How has it been from your end of things? And And how rough was it with
this? You know, it was quite the challenge, both personally and professionally. You know, just you know, from a personal side, just, you know, having, you know, friends, you know, get the virus, having some friends, not my closest friends, but certainly some acquaintances and you know, colleagues, get the virus, and a couple of them unfortunately passing due to complications tied to the virus. You know, it has certainly been hard. Obviously, the school's closed. I have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old, so it was tough with them, and homeschooling the boys and that sort of thing. Plus, just, you know, it's my job, but I'm still a massive college basketball fan. I have been since I was 5 years old. I'm 51 now, just to, you know, to give that some context. And just not having the tournament, I mean, quite honestly, put me in a funk, personally and professionally. And just like everyone, I imagine listening on this call, they have an interest in the sport, of course, and you as well. And it just stunk. I mean, there was obviously reason for it, and it led to, you know, more and more NCAA championships being canceled, and the current season being altered like no other, with fall sports taking place in the spring and so on, staging a tournament this past March, unlike any other. It was grueling putting that together. It was tough being sequestered in a hotel for 28 days. I couldn't see my wife, see my boys. It was challenging, you know, less physically, but, you know, mentally. But we knew it was important to do it. And, you know, thanks to the help of a lot of people, we got it done. And it's something, you know, I'll always be proud of, but God, I don't want to ever do it again.
Yeah. Speaking as a fan, David, looking back at the 2019-2020 season, it's so unfortunate that it will be remembered the way that it was, because up until really that first or second week of March, every week of the season, it was like, oh my God, wow. Chad may or may not remember this. I think the last, we do two or three shows every week at Hoops HD. And I think after one of them, we were on the call talking, and he said, I think that was the best weekend of college basketball I have ever seen. And he may not have been wrong. The storylines with Dayton coming out of nowhere, and like Gonzaga, who's normally really good anyway, but being ranked high, and you had San Diego State, and there was just, every tournament seems like it had storylines going into it, but that one had even more than usual. I hate to drudge up a bad memory, but when the committee did convene for a minute, didn't it? Like, you guys did get together and start to work. Can you talk about sort of what it was like from the time you got there until it became obvious that it wouldn't be able to go forward?
Yeah. Well, you know, we got to New York, the committee, you know, Kevin White, the director of athletics at Duke, was the chair of the committee, and he went in to New York on the weekend, you know, prior to Selection Sunday, and which is normal. The chair goes on CBS during their coverage. Usually, I think it's a noon game involving the American Athletic Conference teams, and he's on set at halftime. Dan Gavitt, our senior vice president for basketball, was there. I went in Tuesday morning, you know, along with a couple other staff members. We got there. I remember checking in to the hotel, and as I was unpacking, I turned the TV on, and the first thing I saw was that the National Guard had been called in New Rochelle, New York, just north of the city, and just to try to sequester people because there had been an outbreak there. And, you know, gosh, just knowing now, you obviously wouldn't have had the same, you know, passive, casual thoughts that I had at the time. Like, gosh, this thing's, it's kind of ridiculous. This is actually a thing, you know. But,
yeah,
I mean, and then 72 hours later, whatever, you know, everything's really falling apart and being canceled, and the world changed, you know, probably for good. And you know, it was tough, you know, from a standpoint of the committee work, you know, they're obviously not, that's not their job to be a member of the Division I Men's Basketball Committee. There are commissioners at, you know, Division I conferences or ADs at Division I institutions, and they have their own, you know, jobs and coaches and sports to oversee. And obviously the coronavirus is impacting not only their men's basketball team, but, you know, women's basketball and other sports that are taking place during the winter. Or the spring sports that have just begun, baseball, softball, obviously starting February at, you know, just about every school. And so we're trying to find the balance of, okay, we have, you know, a field to select here, but they are also dealing things back in their own conferences and campuses. And so we were behind, and it was intentional, of course, because we had to prioritize, you know, what they were doing. So we didn't really get far at all. And that's why there's Twitter chatter, and I've seen it, you know, within the last 4 or 6 weeks, people still demanding to see the 2020 bracket. There wasn't a 2020 bracket. We didn't even get remotely close to doing a bracket. We did the first ballot. The committee submitted their first ballot, which, you know, typically results in 25 or so teams being voted into the tournament. Anyone who's followed college basketball throughout the year can get bare minimum 80% of those right, and that's even the casual fans, the diehards like you, could probably get well past 90% of those schools right. And the results of the first ballot also build our under consideration list, which usually is around 40 schools, but we never even got, you know, much further past that in terms of selecting additional teams from the under consideration and placing them into the field. Or starting on the seed line or anything like that. I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the storylines. It was really going to be interesting. It was, you know, you hope it's not a once in a lifetime achievement for San Diego State and Dayton, schools like that. But I mean, they're outstanding programs. There's no question about that. But both of those programs just had it going on another level. They were as good as teams in the country. And, you know, they were final, not only Final Four good, they were national champion good. And, you know, they may not have, you know, in the next year or two or three, an opportunity to be, you know, a one seed. You know, like I said, those programs are tremendous. You know, fan support is
awesome
for those schools. I mean, I love going to Dayton games. I went to three in Orlando one year in November over Thanksgiving a few years back, and it was
their fans were ridiculous. This is going to sound crazy, but myself, Chad, and John, I think everybody that works with the site has a living room or a, you know, man cave or something set up where you have four or five screens where you can watch that many games at the same time. And it seems like through much of 2020, that still wasn't enough. It was just an incredible year. I hate that it didn't end that way. Sorry,
yeah. But David, I kind of want to get into, you know, you talked about, you know, how it was, how awful everything was with that 2020 tournament, you know, falling apart. We did get through the season though. We got a 2021 tournament that came off pretty well, despite a ton of changes in how everything was picked and how the season was conducted and games being canceled and rescheduled at the last minute. And I just want to know from your point of view and maybe going forward here, do you think anything beneficial did come out of this? Do you think we learned anything that may help change how things are run going forward now with college basketball and with the tournament selection committee?
I mean, as it relates to selections, there's a lot of things, you know, we're evaluating. We meet with the basketball committee in about a month, and you know, the agenda will be quite extensive from a broadcast standpoint, from a scheduling standpoint, from a media standpoint. You know, obviously things were done, you know, press conference wise via you know, virtual Zoom press conferences. And while I don't anticipate, you know, that we'll be going exclusively to that, I think there's opportunity to continue on with virtual press conferences, and that allows people who do cover the game but aren't credentialed for the game to view the press conferences and participate them in real time. And so from my standpoint, there's certainly, you know, those possibilities. You know, there might be some things, quite honestly, Chad, long term, you know, that I think will be looked at. A lot of people have asked about a single site tournament, and you know, we've selected the preliminary round sites for the next, you know, 5 years or so. But I think it's possible that, you know, and I'm certain that we'll have the conversations about, you know, that works so well. And the feedback we received from, you know, the participating schools, coaches, players we spoke to, they really liked that environment. Indianapolis, I'm biased because I live here. But Indianapolis is a perfect setting for that type of thing because everything is so contained with hotels, restaurants. Obviously, the venues are all close. So you could do something like we did this year, except you'd have the atmosphere of fans being in the building and fans walking around the city and it being more festive. It doesn't necessarily have to be for all rounds of the tournament. You know, maybe it's Sweet 16 through the national championship, but those type of format type things will certainly be up for discussion.
Wow. John, I want to throw it over to you. I know you had a couple questions also.
Sure. First is my comment, David, especially with the Zoom press conferences for the tournament. I cannot stress enough how much I love them because I had the chance to ask questions of like national champions like Scott Drew and Jared Butler. It was fantastic. So I know I'm just one vote. And I'm not even a vote, but I strongly recommend you keep it because it was fantastic. As far as a question, I wanted to start out by looking back at the 2021 tournament. When you have one seeds like Gonzaga and Baylor make it to the title game, is that something that's rewarding because it shows that you guys picked the right teams and they proved it, that they were the best teams in America? Or is it just a happy coincidence because seeding is not the same as predicting who's going to win the tournament?
You know, that's a great question, John. You know, I think if you took any 10 people, whether they're administrators at schools and conferences or 10 people off Twitter who are just, you know, in the know in terms of following college basketball, you know, from November through March, you weren't going to find teams, you know, better than Gonzaga and Baylor. I think they were a clear-cut 1-2. I don't think any, you know, committee member would pat themselves on the back and say, oh, we got that right, and brag on it. It did play out that way. It doesn't play out that way all the time. And that's not just men's basketball. The Arkansas Razorbacks got knocked out of the Super Regional, the baseball championship on Sunday. They were the number one team all year long, and they didn't make it to the College World Series. You know, so anything can happen in sports. And that's, by the way, that's many, many years in a row where the overall number one seed didn't win the national championship in baseball. In basketball, it's you know, you only get one loss, whereas baseball, you could suffer a few losses on your path to a national championship and survive it because of the double elimination format. But with basketball, it's a one and done thing. You know, anything can happen. You just have to go to 2018 to see what happened with UMBC. It's just a tremendous event like that. As far as the committee goes, you know, no committee member in the, you know, 16 years I've been doing this has ever, you know, been down on themselves or down collectively as a group for picking a team that some question and then they perform poorly in the tournament. And on the flip side, no committee member's ever given the "I told you so." I've given the "I told you so," I still do. I mean, I know people questioned George Mason's inclusion in 2006 and people questioned VCU's inclusion in 2011. The committee didn't select those teams because they thought they were going to the Final Four, to be clear. But at the same time, this committee watches a ton of basketball. They have countless conversations with coaches, getting feedback from them, getting feedback from administrators from every conference across the country. You know, whether it's the SWAC in the Northeast Conference or the ACC in the Big 12 and the Big 10. So every conference is vetted. Two committee members are responsible for oversight of the conference from day one of the season. So a lot's invested. And those committee members recognize those teams were worthy of inclusion in the tournament. Now, did we adjourn on Sunday and go, hey, watch George Mason, you know, knock off a tremendous Connecticut team in the Elite Eight and get to the Final Four. Of course not, they didn't. But it also shows that the people who think the committee just comes in on, you know, the selection week and just says, okay, what do we do? And looks at the RPI, looks at the net and selects teams. I mean, they couldn't, you know, be, that couldn't be further from the truth.
I'm glad you made that point, David, because like it really is on November 9th of this year, all 10 committee members will probably be watching no fewer than 3 or 4 games. And it'll be that way every night for the rest of the season. I did want to ask you something about sort of how they go about evaluating all the conferences, because if you look at the hierarchy of college basketball, you have your Power Five, and then maybe a tier below that, you have your other multi-bid conferences that may not be power conferences, but they're still sending their first and second and sometimes more to the NCAA tournament. And then you kind of get to the rung that I hate the term mid-major. It's not allowed at Hoops HD, but what we call them is the under-the-radar conferences, which are roughly the 21 or 22 single-bid leagues. And we love those leagues. If you're a fan of a school that's in a league like that, it feels like in order to impress the committee, you have 6 weeks at the beginning of the year to do it. You have to get first the game scheduled, then be fortunate to schedule the kinds of games that are going to be against teams that play out to be as good as you think they will, which isn't always easy when you look at the top 25 at the end of the year as opposed to the preseason top 25. And you got to play those games a lot of the times under very unfavorable circumstances on the road and sometimes on the road on a bus. I'm not saying it can't be done. It's been done before. It will be done again. But is there any consideration or something to a team that might be in a different circumstance than, say, a team in a power conference that gets chance after chance after chance at the kind of wins that end up in Tier 1 or Tier 2, as opposed to maybe an Ohio Valley school or a Missouri Valley school or anybody from those leagues that this doesn't have that circumstantial, what I would say, advantage?
Yeah, I mean, the committee, it's a great question, first of all, David. The committee – again, spends, an ungodly amount of time evaluating these teams and watching them. That's one thing that's, where the world is, a much simpler place, is that because of live streaming and things like ESPN3, you can watch teams, much easier than you could in the past. It used to be if there'd be an occasional game featuring, whether it's Missouri Valley or A-10 or Mountain West teams on TV, now all those games and even the leagues that are one bid leagues year after year, you can watch those games and committee does. And then Synergy also allows each committee member has a subscription there and, allows you to watch the games and especially the top teams in those leagues, and plus the conversations that they have with administrators. And every week the conference sends me a form, someone from the league office sends me a form that has every possible note you can imagine about player availability, if a key player, starter or reserve, was injured or sick, that might offer some explanation into a team's performance, especially if it was a poor performance, and in details like, pick a team got stuck in a blizzard, flying to Syracuse or something. And so they didn't get to the Carrier Dome until an hour and a half before tip and still put up a good fight and maybe have won if they didn't have those type of issues. So all those type of details are shared. I do think the committee's more educated as the years have gone by with about the strength of those teams and using analytics to evaluate those teams. A year ago, not a year ago, so it would have been 2 years ago, I think it was UNC Greensboro was the last team left out of the tournament. They would have been in the tournament had Oregon not, you know, won the Pac-12 AQ and, you know, kind of stolen that bid. And I think UNC Greensboro was in, not because they had, you know, a bunch of wins in the first quadrant and their net was, you know, high, but it was more, you know, other analytics that suggested, you know, that their wins, their results against their schedule were comparable to, you know, results, you know, that some Power Five and or Power Six, if you will, conference or members schools had, and that's why, you know, they were in the discussion. So that has evolved a lot. I'm happy to say that, and I think it's meaningful. I think the move to the net is certainly modernized, you know, the sorting tool that we use, you know, versus the old RPI, but we're still using external metrics. And those, you know, we completely recognize that those have value and you know, and don't have biases in them towards you know, any particular school or conference.
That is very refreshing to hear, because, like, for Conference USA, for instance, like Western Kentucky and, you know, some of those schools win over 90% of their games at home. It's hard to go in there and win. And while that might not be a quad one or quad two win, that's a hell of a win.
Exactly right. You know, anytime you play a team on the road, especially, you know, the good one, let's use Conference USA as an example. This year, I think there were 7-8 teams within three games of first place.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the year. I was just talking about the year where Greensboro was really good. I think it was 18-19. This is what happened.
Yeah, it was. Wofford was outstanding that year too.
Yeah, Wofford was just, you know, Wofford was a great team, but that year in 18-19, Western Kentucky was really good, and there was, UAB, I think, was Old Dominion was really good that year, and so, I mean, so that you're talking about, you know, when half the team, you know, or even if you count the teams that went, like, you know, say they went, 7-9. How many conferences? They play 18 conferences. Let's say the 8 and 10 teams, the 8 and 10 teams in Conference USA, you know, well, I mean, they're obviously competitive games, competitive teams, especially at home. So you could play a 10th place team in that league on the road. And if you win, that's a pretty dang good win. It's not a gimme.
I'm so happy you think so.
David, you mentioned the net there, and I know it's been a few years now that the NCAA has been using the net. Do you think it's really worked out the way that you were hoping it to? And do you see any changes in it, or is it kind of still an evolving formula? Or do you think we're kind of where we are with the net in terms of the way the NCAA is calculating it?
I don't anticipate it changing. I mean, it's a learning tool that, you know, that takes data from previous years. So every year you have more data involved with the algorithm, and we compare it to other, you know, metrics to make sure nothing's completely out of whack. Now we start at ground zero with every year. You know, there's no past data that's in, you know, like in Ken Pomeroy's metric. It does take into, you know, returning players and their statistics and those type of things. So from that standpoint, it does take the net more time as the season starts to sort of make sense. That's why we made the decision not to release it until early December. It ended up being mid-December this year because the season started, I think 10 days later, 15 days later than it was scheduled to. But now that we're, you know, hopefully back on track in a normal world, I think the net will come out in early December. I know there's a huge appetite from the membership, coaches, the media, and the general public to see the rankings, but, you know, they obviously are wonky at the beginning, and, you know, and it's because there's just not a lot of data. And once there's, you know, a bunch of games played, then the data starts to sort itself out and normalize and align with, other metrics that are out there.
I'm glad you made that point, because that's what, you know, I've seen every year where the net comes out, a bunch of yelling and screaming about, you know, how can certain teams be in a certain place. But as we reach into get into mid and late February, I think the numbers do kind of start matching up with how I've seen teams. I mean, I think we moved some teams that are a little off, but
yeah, quick story. I mean, we, you know, the first year we knew it was going to be like that because, you know, we partnered with Google and there's some pretty smart people who work at Google, know what they're talking about. And, you know, they were like, well, we should wait until, you know, some of the numbers materialize. And I was like, well, or we could just release it and just watch everyone lose their minds because, you know, we made
the announcement
the previous spring, you know, that we were getting rid of the RPI and everyone wrote RIP to the RPI. And then the next day, everyone like, they couldn't wait to see this net ranking. And so, you know, the first day, I don't even remember who was ranked where, but I'm sure it was, you know, some smaller school at number one and it just drove everyone crazy. Like, oh, the net's broken. Literally a very prominent analytics person, you know, not just sports, but political analyst said, this is the worst metric ever. You know,
I know who that was. I'm not going to say, but I sent him a reply that I thought was pretty epic. I sent him what the RPI would have been and it was worse.
Yeah. And then it, you know, by the end of the year, you know, you look at it and I think 13 of the top 16 in the net made the Sweet 16. You know, the one outlier was Oregon, which no metric had, you know, ranked high. And Oregon was obviously, like I just mentioned, got in only because, you know, it won the Pac-12 AQ and but then stayed hot and won their first two tournament games as well. But, you know, we're very happy, you know, with it. We think we tweaked it a little bit a little over a year ago last spring to try to simplify it a little bit. And, you know, we think it's working. There's no plan to change it for the coming year. The big storyline this year was obviously Colgate. It was, you know, obviously the committee ignored the net as it pertained to Colgate just because of, you know, them only playing just a few schools. You know, while Colgate had a very good team, certainly had a tremendous showing in the tournament against Arkansas in a game that the final score certainly not indicative of how competitive that game was. But at the same time, I don't think anyone on the committee thought Colgate was the ninth or 10th best team in the country either. And they were seeded accordingly.
Yeah, they did a great job being Army about 13 times last season, I think. Tytel, I know you had something else you wanted to throw out there.
Yeah, just going back to the 2021 tournament, David, I was wondering, as a stats guy who's been doing this a long time, if you had a favorite stat or moment from the tournament. There were so many amazing things, like a 15 seed getting to the Sweet 16. We saw the buzzer beater in the Gonzaga-UCLA game. We saw the heavyweight fight in the title game. Does anything stand out for you looking back on it a few months later?
You know, I'd like to give a better answer than this, and maybe as I'm talking, I'll think of something. But, you know, the UCLA-Gonzaga game is one of the best sporting events I've ever seen. You know, and that's not an exaggeration. It's easy to say one of the best Final Four games or, you know, one of the best you know, tournament games, things of that nature, but it was much more than that for me. That's a game I immediately went to our production team that produces, you know, the press conferences and backs up, you know, our CBS and Turner to make sure everything goes right. And I got a thumb drive with that game. And that's just a keeper. It's one of those get bored the summer after my kids finish baseball season and put that baby in and rewatch that game. It was just an incredible game. Other than that, I mean, I would say, obviously, you know, Oral Roberts being, you know, two heavyweights in Ohio State and Florida, the performance Loyola Chicago had against Illinois, I mean, it was just a beautiful brand of basketball that day, the way they played. Ohio, it seems like every time Ohio's in the tournament, they do some damage. They did it again, knocking out the defending champs. Abilene Christian beating Texas as a former Division II guy who, you know, worked at a school that, you know, sometimes played Abilene Christian in some sports. It was just remarkable. I couldn't imagine what they were thinking beating not only winning an NCAA tournament game, but doing it against Texas just had to be remarkable.
They just recently came up. So,
yeah, exactly. The new division one team in the last few years. There was just a lot of things, along those lines. Oregon State, just, tremendous performance. Every time, they did something in the Pac-12 tournament, you were like, because I'd seen them play several times and never would have dreamed that, they would be one step from the Final Four. They were tremendous in March, and they were in our hotel and just seemed like just a fun group of guys and their coaching staff. And so it was fun, memorable tournament. Not much negative that I could think of outside of the one obvious one, and that was the situation with VCU. It was just the one thing we just hoped and prayed wouldn't happen, and sadly it did. And we lost one of the games, and one of the teams didn't get to compete in our tournament that they earned every right to participate. So that was the one thing. There were some, the games seemed to be hit or miss. There were some unbelievable games, and we had some other, a lot of games that, weren't quite as competitive as they appeared on paper, but that's the kind of stuff you can't control, and that's what happens in sports.
Yeah, David, as a Rutgers alum myself, who suffered for many, many years not seeing my team in advance, I'm glad you did not mention Houston's comeback against us in that second.
I mean, isn't it funny how Houston doesn't do that. I mean, what happened? Because then I think Rutgers would have played Syracuse, and because Houston played Syracuse in Sweet 16, and Rutgers, had already beaten them once. So, and obviously what Houston did going all the way to the Final Four, everything changes, in the first round or second round, that would have been.
There was that path to the Final Four for Rutgers.
David, everything you just said, I have said to Chad about 100 times. I just felt the need to remind him. And about Oral Roberts, I was astounded when they beat South Dakota State in the semis of the Summit, much less went on to do what they did.
Oh, it's crazy. They were the first team. I think they were the first team to get to Indianapolis, and they were also at the JW Marriott where we were staying. And quick personal story, their assistant coach is a guy named Solomon Bozeman. And Solomon, who just last week was named the head coach at Arkansas Pine Bluffs, now he's a Division I coach. Well, Solomon was a little kid when I first met him. His father was the basketball coach at Henderson State, my alma mater. Wow. So I've known Solomon his whole life. Solomon, his dad, Eric Bozeman, became an assistant coach on Rod Barnes' staff. So he left Henderson State to go to Ole Miss. So Solomon kind of grew up in Oxford. Then Coach Bozeman went to Southern Arkansas University in Magnolia, and Solomon finished his high school career at Magnolia High School in Arkansas, and signed with South Florida out of high school, transferred to Arkansas Little Rock, and Solomon was in the first four game in 2011. He was a Sun Belt Player of the Year, played in the inaugural first four, and here he is 10 years later, coaching in the tournament. And it was just kind of a cool thing. And I saw Solomon and went and talked to him. And I mean, there's no way he would remember me, but his dad gave him a heads up that I was, going to go find him. Dan Gavitt, and I talked to him, met their head coach, talked, they're playing Ohio State in a 2-3 game. We're thinking, enjoy your stay in Indianapolis, let us know what you need. We didn't think we'd be seeing them for the next 10 days or whatever. That's how it worked out, just because of, just tremendous performance. And, and they're also, 2-3 inches from knocking off Arkansas in the Sweet 16 and, playing Baylor in the Elite Eight. So,
right.
They were just a tremendous team, a lot of fun to watch. Admittedly, I did not see much of them all year. I made a point to watch them because of Solomon once, and then I watched one of the conference tournament games. I don't think it was the South Dakota State game, but may have been a quarterfinal. But, you know, just tremendous story, you know, and tremendous run they had in March.
Yeah. One of the other questions that I had, David, was there were fewer out-of-conference games, and then within the conferences, the schedules weren't exactly balanced. I don't know how big of a deal that was because there's so many conferences that lack balance now anyway, but did the fewer games make it harder to evaluate the teams?
I think so. I mean, I think we were worried at the start of the season about just how many of these non-conference games or even the league games, you know, would get played. And we were tracking on the number of Division I games because everyone had to play 13. And just about everyone reached that number. I think from a, you know, from a evaluating the teams from that standpoint, you know, the Google folks, once we reached a certain threshold of teams playing, you know, four or five non-conference games, they thought the net would be effective because it's obviously incestual and that, you know, it doesn't work when everyone just plays the same teams within your own game. And, you know, it certainly made the committee's job a bit more challenging, but I don't think it ended up being as challenging as it could have been. And, you know, like the Big Ten, for example, in baseball, that those teams, they just played a Big Ten schedule, and it made it tough to evaluate the baseball committee recently in their selections over Memorial Day. It was tough to evaluate Big Ten teams because you just didn't have you know, a whole lot of non-conference to go off. So it would have been difficult that the non-conference games didn't get played, but and we certainly had concern that would be the case, but in the end, we've got like four enough data points for the committee.
And sort of a similar question. Again, we like those under the radar teams, and you're in the rare instance that you feel like that you have a team that can get inside the bubble, meaning they can make the field without having to win the conference tournament. That's just sort of a term we use, inside the bubble. You rely heavily on those out of conference portion of the season. I guess, well, that's more of a comment than a question. I guess the question is, would you say it's beneficial to play UC Santa Barbara, Belmont, Loyola Chicago, some of these teams that you know coming into the year are going to be really good if you're in a bigger conference in a multi-bid league, or should you avoid them?
Yeah. My personal opinion is it's great for the game. I just think, you know, the regular season is terrific, but there would be added value if some of those, you know, big dog played some of the schools you're talking about. And not because I think some schools just don't play them because whether it sounds bad to lose to them or looks bad to lose to them, but I mean, you go to Nashville and get you some of that Belmont action, you can get a good chance to go home with a loss, you know, and schools know that. And you know, it's the way things are set up right now. It's really like that for all sports.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when people ask me, you know, from a scheduling philosophy, you know, if I'm a school, like Wofford, you know, you may not be able to get South Carolina or Clemson to come to your place. And that's fine. But if you have to go on the road, well, don't go to Duke, Kentucky and Oklahoma and get three losses, you know, but try to go to some of the mid-level schools in those where you'd actually have a chance, you know, to win, because, you know, going to Cameron or going to Rupp, it's great for your kids to get that experience and playing in those venues, but the odds of coming out with a win are not good because those teams are exceptional. However, going to, you know, a mid or lower level team in the SEC or ACC, you can get those wins. And it looks, but the other thing the committee tries to do is the attempts at scheduling, because you could play a team that's coming off a 25 win, you know, second round appearance in the NCAA tournament, and you get them on the schedule, and whether they're hurt by injuries or transfers, or just have a bad season for whatever reason, poor chemistry, wherever, all of a sudden what you're thinking is going to be a quadrant one or upper level quadrant two win or game turns into a quadrant three. And then the other thing, the last thing I'll say to that is you can look at when the committee looks at when you played a team. There was a team, I don't know if I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it was just a few years ago. It was Minnesota. And Minnesota, you know, at the first, maybe not the first half might be an exaggeration, but close to the first half of the season, they were playing tremendous basketball. And in the second half of the season, they just had done a 180. And, you know, so a win over Minnesota didn't look quite as good at the end of the year. But the committee can look at it and go, well, they beat Minnesota in December. And Minnesota in December was a far different club than Minnesota at the end of February. So all of that, you know, can play into the equation.
Right. That is great advice for the under-the-radar schools. The other thing I preach, and you can shoot this down and I'll never mention it again, I'd like to see them play each other a little more than they do. The top schools,
Those tops, like the Belmonts and...
Yeah, like, have Belmont play Wofford, or like, you know, I'm trying to think. I'm a little rusty.
Stephen F. Austin.
Yeah, SFA is really good. Western Kentucky is really good. Like, you don't even have to go that far for those teams to play each other sometimes.
Oh, no. I mean, just imagine, I would love to see, you know, an eight-team event that has, you know, some of the schools you're mentioning, you know, Liberty and
Liberty's another one.
Wofford, Stephen F., Loyola, Chicago. I mean, Winthrop, it's high level.
Yeah, Winthrop, another great team. Yeah.
Just high level basketball. And it would help them in terms of, you know, metric. Now, some of the coaches may go, well, yeah, and I may walk out of there 0-3. That's a real possibility too. So I get that, but I loved the ESPN when they had the
what
they call it, bracket buster. Yes, I mean, if I was in charge of the world and had 100 things I could do that were sports related, rest assured, bracket busters returning would be one of them.
Well, the TV deals kind of ate a lot of that up, but you're right. I would. It's just, would you play each other? And if you go 0-3, then you go 0-3. You're no worse off than just going to the bakery like you normally do. Anyway, I'm sorry, Chad.
I know, John, you had something else you wanted to throw out there.
Yeah, David, you mentioned a couple times about being in the same hotel as some of the teams. It occurred to me, I've not heard too many stories about what it's like to be in a bubble for several weeks at a time. So what was it like?
As miserable as you might think. you know, we were, it's not even being in a, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Indianapolis, but JW Marriott's a large property, but we were confined basically to two floors. We were, I think if my memory's right, we slept on the fourth floor. All the rooms for the committee and the staff were on the fourth floor. And the third floor was, you know, during selections, that's where we met. And then there were a few offices where we worked from, and down the halls where we did daily COVID testing. So every day we woke up and at 7:30, we stuck large Q-tips up our nose, 28 days in a row. So, it was we couldn't have guests. Everything was blocked off. There was a path that allowed us to walk, to the connector that got you to the convention center. The convention center was blocked off, and so you could go there. And at the convention center, they turned a bunch of ballrooms into practice courts, and you could watch teams practice for a little while. The committee could do that and talk to coaches and administrators who were inside the school's respective bubble. So the school had a party of, I think the number was 34. people in their tier one travel party, and you know, those 34 had to stick together. They couldn't go out. No one else could come in. Once the bubble started, you were in the bubble, so you couldn't join midstream or anything like that. For food, we were basically given a link every day, and they picked a restaurant and said, you know, here's the restaurant. They gave you like three or four options to choose, and you picked it, and they brought the food to this ballroom, and then you had to walk down to the ballroom and pick it up. And, you know, depends on what you were doing. I mean, there were plenty of times that had some, you know, a cold burger and some cold tots or whatever.
But, yeah. You know, so it was pretty much your floor, your little meeting room or ballroom, and the baseball field.
Yes. And so
you could go out there and like walk around the baseball field.
The committee members went for walks. A lot of walks every morning. And then the teams could access those. There was one path you could take to get to the baseball field. Players would just kick a soccer ball around or play catch with a football. One day I went out there with Dan Gabb. Dan just came down and looked at me, and I was like in the middle of something that was kind of pressing. And he looked at me, he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Why?" He goes, "I got to get out of here, man." I said, "I do too." He goes, "Let's go for a quick walk to the baseball field. I know you're busy." I said, "All right, let's do it." So we walked. It was a beautiful day. It was the first time I'd had fresh air in like 11 days.
Yeah.
No lie. And Mark Few was out there, and we ended up just shooting the breeze with Mark Few for 20 or 30 minutes. And and then we walked back to the hotel.
Yeah.
And I made the joke like then. I was like, I feel like, you know, Red and Andy Dufresne and Shawshank Redemption just on the yard talking.
Yeah.
So it was bizarre. That was the yard, the Victory Field with the Indianapolis Indians play. That was our little.
Yeah. One more quick question, David. I know that, I guess there's a lot of people out there that try to predict what the committee is going to do each year. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that the committee is always changing each year. And this year in particular, you actually have, because the committee is expanding by two members, you have five new members coming in. Do you think that's going to really change? Like how can we see like material changes for how that works with five new people coming onto the committee this year?
You know, that's a great question, Chad. I think it's certainly making us reevaluate our principles and procedures. I don't think the whole process will change in terms of how we select, how we seed, how we bracket. But at the same time, you have to look at it from the standpoint of, like, for example, when we cast our initial ballot, if a team such as Michigan, which doesn't have an AD on the, you know, their AD is not on the committee. So when the committee's casting their initial ballot, Michigan needs at least eight votes. It's all but two eligible votes to get in the tournament on that initial ballot. Now, if it's the AD, since Iowa State's AD is on the committee, then they need seven of the nine votes, because Iowa State's AD, Jamie Pollard, can't vote for his own team. So that's how our principles are written, all but two eligible votes to get it. At the same time, to get on under consideration, you have to have received at least three votes. Well, now that the committee's expanded from 10 to 12, we're reevaluating that. We've got some proposals in place that the committee will review next month, and then, you know, we'll have updated principles and procedures, you know, ready to be public, because that is a public document, how the whole thing works. So we'll have that, you know, ready to go, I'd say, by the end of July.
I've read that document many times. So.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm glad you asked that question, because procedurally, I was wondering how that would work. But yeah, it's like, if your AD's on the committee, it essentially assumes a vote of yes, because instead of 8 out of 10, it's 7 out of 9.
Right.
So, yeah. I'd vote for my team if I was on it and allowed to, but just assumed that I would.
but just to be clear, you know, committee members can't vote for their own team. I mentioned Kevin White earlier. I mean, not only could Kevin not vote for Duke, but he could, you know, he has sons who were coaches, you know, obviously, and ADs. So he couldn't vote for Florida, and he couldn't vote for Central Florida. So, and we have those, you know, built in place too.
Wow, so, I didn't realize it extended that far. The joke that I was kind of making is that, like, even if it's almost as if you did vote for them, because whether you voted for them or not, you needed 7 more votes in addition to your own to get them there, is kind of what I was saying. But most of my jokes bomb, David, don't worry about it.
No, that's me, that's on me for not getting it.
So okay, yeah,
that was okay. I got you now.
Yeah.
But, well, I guess, David, though, with this year, you kind of have almost, you know, 5 new people to almost train on how to be on the committee, which is normally there's only 2 new people. I mean, you're going to have 5 new voices in the room, as opposed to, I guess, most years you only have 2 or 3 new voices in the room. Do you see that being affecting things also, or?
Yeah, it'll be on us, and by us, I mean, you know, it's primarily, I'd say, Joanne Scott, and from a selection standpoint, mm-hmm. Joanne Scott and who's our managing director for men's basketball, and myself, you know, we'll be the ones responsible for, you know, initiating them. The new committee members will attend the summer meeting that's scheduled for next month, even though it's a virtual meeting. You know, but we'll have them ready in terms of the selection, how everything works. And, you know, we used to go to the campuses, Joanne and I, and you know, I remember one time we drove up to Toledo and talked to Michael Bryan. I can remember going to Dallas to speak with Southland Conference Commissioner Tom Burnett, who's now, you know, will be the chair for the 21-22 season. So, you know, we feel like we have, you know, a really good group of new committee members, you know, representing, all different conferences and things of that nature. But, you know, with Mark Coyle, Minnesota, and Martin Jarman from UCLA, and Greg Byrne from Alabama, and then let's see who else. Barry Collider from Butler, who's working on the NIT, and Keith Gill, the commissioner of the Sun Belt, who's, you know, former staff member. So I think we have some people that, you know, we'll get it. And the other ones, you know, there'll be some virtual training about how the conference monitoring program that I mentioned earlier works, and then the selection process. You know, we'll talk to them about it. But also in February, we have an orientation meeting that also serves as that early bracket release that we do in mid-February, where we do the top 16 seeds. The primary purpose of that meeting actually is to have a refresher for the returning committee members and orient them.
Barry Collier, I mean, that is a good group. Barry Collier, also a former successful coach back in his day too. He's done everything. I couldn't, before we're nearing the end here, David, I need to say this. I think I said this last time. I have to throw it out there. If you ever want us to take over this process, we are here for you.
Hey,
you never know. We will select the field.
If you need a 13th or 14th, 15th, let us know also.
It's amazing how many people volunteer for that.
Yeah.
What you're doing is setting yourself up for just a bunch of hatred on Twitter. So.
Oh, we get that anyway.
Yeah. You know, I try to be transparent on Twitter. I mean,
yeah.
I can remember being on the other side of it, you know, and going, you know, are they a 3 seed? Why is this team not included? You know, and all that stuff, and listen to conspiracy theories. And of course, this is before the days of social media. But yeah. You know, it really is a solid process, and the committee is unbelievably responsible. Does a lot, puts in a lot of work to make it happen. I know, you know, people are going to say things, and you know, to act like there's something, you know, not right about the process, but nothing can be further from the truth. It's a tremendous committee. And then with Dan Gavitt's leadership, you know, Dan, Joanne, I just mentioned, myself, and LJ Wright from the men's basketball staff, the 4 of us guide them through the process. You know, they make all the decisions, but they're all informed, and they do a tremendous job year in and year out.
Oh, David, I do want to thank you for joining us. This has been great, and you and all everyone over there at the NCAA, I think, just does an amazing job with, you know, trying to get that many teams down into a field and bracketed and figure out seeds and all of that every year, and probably starting as soon as the championship game is over, start to look towards next season every year. But again, thanks for joining us here today.
Yes. And thank you again for all the work you did and that your staff did, because I don't think a lot of people listening to this realize this. This year's tournament was extremely important to the health of college athletics in general, especially for a lot of maybe under-the-radar schools and under-the-radar non-revenue programs. Like, without it, would we have seen fewer baseball teams? Would we have seen fewer soccer teams? It was – I didn't think they would get it in. I'll be honest. When the season started, I'm like, we're never going to get to the finish line, but we did. And I know that it wasn't easy. I hope you didn't need a nose job after all of those tests once that was over.
No, thankfully. Most people just would suggest a total facelift for me anyway, or face replacement. But no, I appreciate all those kind words. It's been a while since I've had a long, extensive talk, just talking hoops, and so I really enjoyed it and appreciate being on the show.
All right, thanks for doing it.
Thanks again, and thank everybody for joining us tonight. David Warlock, our special guest from NCAA, and on behalf of John Titel and David Griggs as well, I'm Chad Sherwood. I'll talk to you again real soon.